This is The Guardian.
Today, why Britain's secretive foreign intelligence service is moving into the open. For much of the last century, the main focus of Britain's Foreign Intelligence Service, MI6, was winning the Cold War.
Every evening I left the office with a big briefcase full of reports which I had written myself, full of files taken out of the actual documents, out of the actual archives.
It was a world of Soviet double agents, secretive meetings, dead letter drops, and disappearing ink.
I used to hand them to my Soviet contact in the evening. Next morning, I'd get the file back, the contents having been photographed, and take them back early in the morning and put the files back in their place.
And for most of its history, the very existence of MI6 was itself a state secret. Officially, it didn't exist. It operated in legal grey areas without clearly defined rules on what it could do.
But the thing is, the game has changed dramatically. I can remember talking to a senior spy recently. He said it wasn't that long ago, at the start of their career, that what you do is you turn up into the country you're interested in with a fake passport and a load of cash, and you take it from there, yeah?
But as that world fades into the past, MI6 is coming out of the shadows.
There's been this very, very slow detente, this very slow emergence into the light.
Now we don't just know that it exists, we know who runs it too.
But we have come a long way, and I well remember when I joined the service in the 1980s, absolutely the identity of C was not revealed, but we have moved on a bit.
Not only that, the new boss, Richard Moore, believes that the way it can stay effective is by being a lot more open about what it does.
In a modern democracy, it is important that I, from time to time, judiciously, come and share some thoughts on what my service does, the sort of challenges that we face.
And he's laid out those challenges for all to see. Technological threats that are a world away from the espionage of the Cold War, where international rivals are building increasingly aggressive capabilities, and where, for the UK and its allies, winning is anything but certain. From The Guardian, I'm Nosheen Iqbal. Today in Focus, is MI6 fit for the future? Dan Saber, you're The Guardian's defence and security editor. In July 2020, MI6 got a new C, which is their code name for the chief of the service. And up until quite recently, as you've said, we'd never know their real name. But times have changed. Can you tell me about Richard Moore?
His background is absolutely sort of classic MI6, I guess.
I've always been an intelligence officer to the core of my soul.
He's come from Oxford. It was there that he was recruited, getting the infamous tap on the shoulder from a talent spotter, I think is the way he's described it in the past, and was kind of interviewed in the rather splendid building in the Mall, and in his words. And before long, a life in the shadows followed.
Well, yeah, even though the gentleman has passed away, I will respect the confidence of the individual who did it. But very much the way that people read about, I think he suggested that I might be interested in a career in a parallel field of foreign affairs. I had no idea what he meant.
He is, on the one hand, a stereotypical Whitehall, Oxbridge figure, but he also knows that the agency needs to change dramatically, otherwise it won't succeed in the future.
Good morning. I am delighted to be here for my first public speech as chief of SIS, or MI6, as it is more popularly known.
So last week, Moore broke cover and gave his first live broadcast interview alongside his first public speech since taking up the role. Dan, you were in the room when he delivered that speech. How unusual is it for the head of MI5 or MI6 to do that?
It was exceptionally unusual a few years back, but it's kind of becoming an annual event. So both agency chiefs at 5 and 6, they both now want to do a speech once a year. And it's kind of like their annual threat assessment, I guess, is sort of the way it's couched. But yeah, this is a significant moment.
But it's still unusual for the holder of this office to give public speeches. This is something that I want to change.
You know, in my line of work, you can spend a lot of time being invited to a secret briefing and then not to be told anything very interesting and wonder why you bothered, yeah? Anyway, that's life. So sometimes these speeches disappoint, okay? This speech did not disappoint.
Second, the changing nature of the threats that we face requires a greater degree of openness from a modern intelligence agency.
It was a sort of warning from Richard Moore that China had become MI6's number one priority, ahead of Russia, ahead of Islamist terror, which is the first time in its history since 1909. China has never been, you know, shot up the radar.
Adapting to a world affected by the rise of China is the single greatest priority for MI6.
And I think one of the things about the world that we're in now, China's got stronger, Russia has also got more assertive. There was a time when Islamist terror was the number one threat for a long time in the aftermath of the Twin Towers, you know, 10 to 15 years. And I think there was a period where people felt that the agencies in the UK had taken their eye off the ball when it came to Russia, but also China, hostile state threats. Over the last 2 or 3 years, since the fall of ISIS, that has really begun to shift. Now there's just a huge focus on China and Russia.
I have seen extraordinary change in the strategic environment from the Cold War to today's starkly contested era, in which nation states and non-state actors, such as terrorists and organized criminals, compete across the domains of the virtual and physical in a world of at times bewildering complexity.
So what they're really saying is, we think the threats that are faced are increasingly technological, that the challenge from China and Russia, it's a hybrid one, right? It's part conventional military. We don't know what happened in Taiwan and Ukraine. Both of things might be conventional military problems, but it's also technological. So who was the audience of his speech? I would say, you know, Beijing and the Kremlin.
You mentioned technological attacks from hostile states, but what exactly would those look like?
China has a kind of intense hacking effort, which is ultimately run by the Ministry of State Security. That has 300,000 people, by the way. So the scale they have is quite, you know, is quite enormous.
The UK and European Union have accused China of carrying out a major cyber attack earlier this year. The attack targeted Microsoft Exchange servers and affected over 250,000 servers all around the world.
What the MSS is thought to do is the Ministry of State Security. They'll run some almost like contract hackers, bunch of hacker groups, hackers for hire. Everyone's looking for state secrets. There's always a certain amount of sort of state-on-state, classic state-on-state spying. Used to be done, obviously, through human means, but you're trying to steal secrets electronically. But also, traditionally, China's incredibly focused on intellectual property and trying to see if it can obtain intellectual property and gain an advantage thereby. It could, of course, be sort of defense, you know, military information, but it could also be technology, medicine.
Intelligence sources tell CBS News Chinese state-backed hackers have been mobilized and laser-focused with one target in mind.
The best, most recent example is, of course, COVID-19 vaccine secrets, right? When there was a strong interest in, if you could just maybe steal a bit of information from the lab, the right man or woman at Oxford, right? You know, you might suddenly get a march on developing a vaccine. This was the worry. A lot of effort was made by the West to try and sort of secure and guard against that.
Tonight, as researchers race to develop a vaccine for the coronavirus, hackers from China and other countries are working just as furiously to steal that research to create their own.
Scientists in Britain will get advice from the intelligence agencies about how to protect yourself. I can assure you that. You've got to understand, though, what technology they're trying to use, what techniques they're trying to use to kind of exploit and get information from people. And some of this is kind of classic human stuff.
You could think that somebody is a bit stupid to accept to go to China and spend a week on a beach and give maybe one lecture and then being surprised of being approached when they come back. But you'd be surprised how easily it's done, you know, hint by hint.
I would advise you that if you're on LinkedIn, you're a search on LinkedIn and you suddenly find that there's an attractive woman, often with a kind of Anglo-Chinese name, this is a classic sort of method where they'll try and recruit, get information out of people. They'll try and sort of say they're a recruitment consultant, they want to offer you a job. Say you work in an industrial company, a biotech firm, or anything that they might be interested in. Maybe you'll come for an interview or have a chat or something. And what they're really trying to do is sort of lure you in and try and get information. And this is kind of classic mode of recruitment.
This is an established technique. This is actually happening.
Yeah.
So it's a tap on the shoulder on LinkedIn.
Well, that's what the Chinese are trying to do, yeah.
Our adversaries are pouring money and ambition into mastering artificial intelligence, quantum computing, and synthetic biology, because they know that mastering these technologies will give them leverage.
So those are the threats MI6 is currently facing. But when it comes to these future technologies, how quickly could they come about?
They say they're really, really worried. They're really, really worried about the pace of change. And I think there is a real fundamental and underlying worry, particularly about China, which is clearly, massively and speedily advancing technologically.
According to some assessments, we may experience more technological progress in the next 10 years than in the last century, with a disruptive impact equal to the Industrial Revolution.
You know, until now, the West has dominated the global technology race. Maybe there's a brief period in the Cold War when Russia was competitive, perhaps in the 1950s, but, you know, not been so since then. And the worry is that actually that it might be possible that China would suddenly leapfrog, that some next iteration of technology somewhere, you know, artificial intelligence is the one most frequently cited, that suddenly they will outsmart us and the traditional advantages we've had in being able to engage in all kinds of monitoring around the world would be eroded. Now, some might say it would be a better world in which there's more competition, perhaps, but they would argue, hang on a minute, China and all so Russia, these are authoritarian regimes and we need to be on our mettle here.
So if, as Moore says, and as you've said, the threats facing the country are different, then it translates that MI6 itself has to change too. Can you tell me a bit more about how that's going to look?
He sort of talked about how there's a sort of paradox at the heart of the intelligence agency here.
It goes as follows. To stay secret, we're going to have to become more open.
And what he means by that is we need to work much more collaboratively with the great technology companies of the world, because the old model across the intelligence agencies was that they would develop their own technology. And I don't mean Q-style smart blood or exploding pens, but nevertheless, they did develop some of their own technology in-house. There's a whole sort of backstory about, you know, secret writing, invisible ink from around the time of the First World War as an example of this. For a long time, they thought they could do it all. The reality is that if that was ever the case, it's definitely not the case now. And the reality is that what the likes of, I don't know, Google and Facebook, but also smart artificial intelligence companies can do, for example, or quantum computing, another area they're interested in, what these sort of leading edge companies can do is far beyond the capacities they can do in the intelligence agencies. So he's really saying, hey, we're here. We don't advertise very much, but we'd really like to work with you. Are you interested in working with us?
How are they going to put this into practice?
We don't have a lot of information, and when it gets to precise details, they don't have too much. But a couple of things have emerged, okay? So one of them is, for example, MI6 and all the other agencies as well, actually, did a big deal with Amazon, US company, you know, not a British company, stating the obvious, right? But did a deal for sort of cloud computing technologies. Now, they said, like, the data's not leaving the UK, there are all sorts of security protections. In the end, the US are our allies. But the kind of key point is that what former insiders are saying is that will allow the analysts to do way faster data analytics, because Amazon's just much better at building this kind of capability than they could do in-house. So that'll allow them to analyze data a lot better. You know, that's one example. Another example, I think this is a bit daft, but it's what they said. They've always had a technology division. So then now they've decided the boss of the technology division is going to be called Q.
Oh, yes, I heard about this. They said that this is where life imitates art, and that actually the name was taken from Bond this time. They love the Bond thing.
They pretend that they don't like the Bond thing, and they go, oh, no. Let me tell you one more time, James Bond is not what it's like being an agent. You know, we have real problems with the image he portrays. They have a love-hate relationship with him. But if you thought it was mostly hate, you realise, no.
People in the tech sector come into business, make their billion, and go out of business in 18 months. You know, that's about the time we might get around to security clearing them. So clearly we have to move that model.
That relationship with tech companies, I mean, how easy will it be, given that MI6 is by nature a secret organisation? I mean, it hardly shares a culture with open source Californian tech companies who just want us all to share our holiday snaps onto the metaverse.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question, actually, because modern people want to share so much of their lives online. They're instinctive talkers and sharers and all the rest of it. And these guys, they don't want the sharers and they don't want the talkers. You know, when you leave the building in Vauxhall or anywhere else, you don't talk about your work. Yeah. Any successes are not shared. I we're now at the level where your partner might know what you do, but no one else is supposed to. Yeah. There is a real culture challenge there. And I think if you go back to the time of Snowden, when it emerged, some technology companies have been partnering with the security agency. Suddenly that became a bad look and they didn't want to do that. Other technology companies began to be much more stronger messaging around privacy. For example, Apple has got some very strong messaging around privacy. So the tech company culture is there's openness and sharing on the one hand and some greater drive to privacy and secrecy in places on the other. So I think it sounds easy to do, but it will be challenging. The other side of the coin, by the way, is the work is amazing. The pay is not great. You can earn a lot more in the technology industry. So if you're trying to recruit some smart computer science folk, how effectively will you be able to work with people who are maybe 30 and sitting on their first set of share options?
There are other ways that MI6 has been trying to transform itself for a while now, and it's ramped up its recruitment drive. Can you tell me a bit more about who it's trying to attract?
So there's two parts to this, and it can be sort of answered simply through the word diversity. The first problem they've got is the classic mode of recruitment is the Oxbridge tap on the shoulder. You know, someone from Corpus Christi College sort of thinks you look like a good chap. You know, come down and have a chat and we can recruit you. But you just recruit in your own image. That is clearly a big problem. You need to recruit people with the relevant language skills, Mandarin speakers, Russian speakers, Arabic speakers, any number of other languages, Pashto for Afghanistan, and people who will blend in the appropriate environment. You know, people who look like the people they're trying to recruit, sound like them, think the same way. Similarly, you need that with technology. You need people. If you're going to try and recruit an agent in a Chinese hacking group or indeed in a Russian hacking group, then you need people who speak their language. And I don't just mean literally as in Mandarin or Russian. I mean also the relevant geek speak, you know, be able to understand what is sort of, you know, what is relevant and not in the kind of hacker community and being able to penetrate that.
More difficult.
Crudely, you know, if you ever wore a beard and moustache when you were skulking on the streets as a young agent, that's not really on anymore. That's not the world we now live in.
If that was ever the world we lived in, Nick, that is certainly not the world we live in now.
Like, the skill set is just not, you know, a man with a striped shirt and a green suit. Apologies to all those. But turning up in a foreign country and kind of hoping to have some nice meetings in a bar or cafe or whatever, now you need people who might well be incredibly cyber literate, who are engaging with people not in country, perhaps, but remotely online.
The serious point here is right. If we are faced with those sort of technological threats to our, if you like, business model, our way of going about doing our job, then we have to stay ahead of that curve.
You're talking about just a very different group of people, and they know they cannot close off their ranks to anybody, which is one of the reasons why they made a big focus this year where they apologized actually very belatedly, but finally for the long period where before 1991, you couldn't be gay, you couldn't be LGBT and work in MI6. Well, if it was known about, people would be thrown out.
Same-sex relationships were decriminalized in 1967. But until 1991, there was a security bar to LGBT plus individuals serving in our intelligence agencies because of the misguided view that they would be more susceptible to blackmail than straight people.
So one of the first things Richard Moore did was he kind of came out and apologised.
This was wrong, unjust and discriminatory. Today, I apologise on behalf of MI6.
They know they have to send this message. MI6 is for everybody. Come and join.
Didn't he film a video with Ian McKellen
yes,
as well?
Yes, he did.
And I'm delighted to be joined today in conversation by Sir Ian McKellen, one of the nation's most cherished actors.
I do think your apology goes beyond the service. It's a representative of the right thing to do.
I do think Moore likes publicity a little bit too much.
You would prefer your spy chiefs talking to you and you only and not being so bloody public-facing.
That is true. That you are right about that. Beautifully put.
So MI6 is making strides to welcome LGBTQ staff. And Moore has also notably been tweeting about Black History Month, about the Social Mobility Index, and presenting this quite progressive face for an organisation that isn't necessarily known to be the most radical place to work. How has all that gone down internally?
They know they need to change their employee structure. They know they need to be more diverse. So this is what ultimately this is all about.
We are intelligence officers, but we don't do what you think.
People recognise that. Everyone recognises the sort of changing nature of the threat.
MI6. Secretly, we're just like you.
Coming up, as MI6 tries to keep up in a world of rapidly evolving threats, is there enough oversight of its growing capabilities? Dan, all these changes we've talked about, I mean, MI6 working with tech companies, it's widening its recruitment. Does it suggest the organisation is worried, like particularly worried about its ability to counter the threats it faces in the modern world? Is it ahead of the game or is it behind it?
They still feel they're ahead. And in the end, the relationship with the Americans, the most capable, well-resourced intelligence services in the world, is incredibly helpful. I think, though, there's a recent study that suggests that China had kind of leapfrogged the UK in kind of terms of sort of cyber intelligence capabilities and so on. And I don't think the British agreed with that. And I don't think they like that.
But say MI6 is successful and that it does develop all these new capabilities in AI and technologies we haven't even yet heard of. Should we be concerned about that outcome? Will there be a strong enough oversight of these new powers?
I think that's an important question, because if you're talking about building more and more sort of powerful computational analytics to look at sort of population data, and I don't know what their capabilities, I'm just kind of speculating a bit, but if you're telling me you can look through the last year's worth of phone calls or even the last week's worth of phone calls and you're starting to look for patterns to detect something, then, you know, you do need some clarity about the things you're trying to look for and who you're trying to focus on. You know, if the focus is quite clear, Russia, you know, threats to the UK, Russia, China, Islamist terror, maybe Iran, North Korea, where there are, you know, real threats to the UK, and ultimately this is set by politicians, then great, that's really very clear. But in the end, you know, these guys do operate in secret, and even the oversight that we have, like the Intelligence Security Committee, that also meets in secret. I think the body would be best working more clearly in public, frankly, and I think we could see what's going on. Because, yeah, as this technological capability increases, the risk for abuse increases, and the public need to have confidence that, you know, state power is being used reasonably and proportionately.
Because the difference between us and the Chinese intelligence services is we have to act within the law.
And these guys will say endlessly, we're not China, we're not Russia, we're not authoritarian regimes, we have a different goal. Great, that's why they engage with the media. But oversight is critical, because, you know, everyone considers bending the rules a bit, don't they, when their parents aren't looking.
Dan, for those of us who are less enamoured with the intelligence agencies, which should we be more worried about? An MI6 that has too much power that we can't even see or hold to account, or not enough to do the work to keep the country safe?
I mean, I'm really hesitating to say this, but I sort of am tempted to argue the balance is about right at the moment. Let's not be naive, okay? There is a real great power competition going on in the world at the moment, right? If the UK and the West doesn't play in this game, China and Russia are going to have a lot more fun. These things are real. The threat from terrorism is real. We need to have a kind of strength and ability to deal with that. And governments need some level of secrecy. So I think these are important capabilities. And I think for relatively modest sums of money, £3 billion a year, I mean, that's a lot to you or me, but it's not a lot in the terms of the public finances. You're getting a good result. So I think the crucial questions are, it's about oversight and what kind of work are they expected to do? But those threats are real. They might not feel part of everyone's everyday life, but if your company's been hacked or you're being hit up on social media by someone from abroad who wants to know, you know, wants to recruit you for a job, your experience might be a bit different.
Dan, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That was Dan Saber. You can find all of his reporting on Britain's intelligence services and much else at theguardian.com. That's it for today. The producer was Sammy Kent. Sound design is by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Mythili Rao. We're back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.